Dhruva Maharaj, we spent some time yesterday evening doing a little introduction. So this is part two. The introduction included Srila Prabhupada's summary of the importance of hearing this Leela. And one of those points is going to come in this evening. And the many nice things from yesterday, kind of preparing the ground for beginning. And the beginning has a very interesting beginning. It doesn't begin right away with Dhruva Maharaj. It begins with a description of the process of creation, or a few verses, really short. The summary of the section that we're covering has got its little subtitle, React or Respond. The react is on the top, and the respond is at the bottom. When difficult situations arise, these are two options. And how do they play out? How does it work? How to take the side of responding instead of reacting, because we have some models to look at in the personalities in this Leela. Yin Yang symbol, that's my idea. There's, in the world that we live, it's a world of duality, and sometimes it's on this side and sometimes on that side, and it keeps moving. And one thing is certain is uncertainty, and especially the times that we're living in, it's really totally uncertain. And how to cope with this or that when it comes. So there's the lower position, the reacting position, and then there's the higher. So let's begin and learn how to respond instead of react. This fourth canto continues. Maitreya is speaking to Vidura from the third canto. And there are some questions asked about Dhruva specifically. And the way it begins, interesting, the four Kumaras, headed by Sanaka, and other sons, Narada, Ribhu, Hansa, Aruni, Yati, all sons of Brahma, they were Naishtika Brahmacharis, unadulterated celibates. Having said that, he then goes into a summary description of the causes of devastation, because creation has been described in Canto 3. So next is causes of devastation. Interesting to insert it. I'm going straight ahead to verse 5, skipping over 2 and 4, because 2 through 4, Maitreya has summarily explained the causes of devastation. We're not going to go into it in detail, but you'll see a chart. One who hears this description three times, I've heard it more than three times, attains piety and washes away sinful contamination from his soul. That's good, because we're bound by the reactions of impiety and the contaminations that come from that. The summary of that section is devastation takes place because of irreligion and falsity. That's the headline. And in those verses 2 through 4, it has a cause-effect kind of description, starting from adharma. So most people don't even know what dharma is. So that's a big factor in modern living. And it leads to mrsha, or falsity. And the combination of those two, irreligion producing falsity, brings a whole series of other things. Bluffing, cheating, greed, cunning, anger, envy, quarrel, harsh speech, that's suniti, death, fear. So this is, these are causes of devastation and at, you know, micro and the macro level and in between. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur raises the question, how is it that all of this helps people become pious, knowing causes of devastation? And specifically, one who hears this description three times attains piety. So how does that work? And his commentary says, by knowledge, one can avoid these items. Now, knowledge doesn't necessarily result in avoiding things that we know are destructive or unwholesome for ourselves or others, but it gives a path for those who are wise to move on. And there's this invitation, you know, this is from a previous presentation. So when you go about this coming period of time, hearing all of this, what are some of the factors that are shown here and how they relate with one another that bring difficulty into life or overcoming them? We'll touch on some of these again as we're going along, specific to the Dhruva story, but how these play out are described. So it's just an application invitation because it's a nice story anyways. Here's a description in these verses of Dhruva's lineage. And to keep it really simple, here's a chart. At the very top, it's Lord Brahma. And he has two, of amongst others, two direct offspring, Swayambhuva Manu and Shatarupa. And they have two sons and three daughters. And the attention in third canto goes to one of those daughters, Devahuti. Not much is said about the other two daughters, Akuti and Prasuti. But a lot is said about Uttanapada, at least in this section. Priyavrat we hear more about in fifth canto. This is the fourth canto. Uttanapada had two queens, Suniti and Suruchi. And Suniti was elder, and Dhruva was the firstborn son. Suruchi was the younger, and Uttama was her son. So that's the lineage. And the father, Uttanapada, he favored the second queen very much. And the first queen, well, he not only didn't favor her, but he literally abandoned her or just left her to her own devices. And Dhruva, the firstborn son, by law, by Vedic law, would become the next king. And from his position, young Dhruva didn't see a difference between his two mothers, his biological mother and his stepmother. He had equal affection and regard for both of them until something else happened where that changed quickly. The theme here now is react and respond. And to keep it in the application realm, how does this apply to us or you? Has there ever been a time in your life when someone mistreated you? Probably yes. And has there ever been a time where you feel that you may have hurt someone else? And when that happened, either one of them, what was your response? So this is kind of a practical application of the Dhruva story here, is how to apply the respond in principle as opposed to the reacting in principle, and what causes one to react, what causes one to respond. So here we go with the first case situation. So Ruchi loses it. Dhruva desired to sit on his father's lap, is the scene. So the verse reads, while the child, Dhruva Maharaj, was trying to get on the lap of his father, Saruchi, his stepmother, became very envious. That's a negative emotion. Envious of the child, with great pride and spite. So that's not a good situation. She began to speak so as to be heard by the king himself. And it's by the painting she not just spoke, but her body language says everything in itself. So there's the king with her son on the king's lap. And Dhruva wanted to sit on the lap, but because of envy and pride, she spoke very harshly. This is the destruction principle from the earlier verses. And we know that envy and pride go together. One who is envious is often proud, and one who is proud is often envious. They're like two sides of the same coin. They're in this destructive realm. So here goes the chart from the earlier verses. Pride brings cheating. Cheating brings greed and cunning. And the two of them produce anger and envy. And then comes the behavior, harsh speech aimed at Dhruva. So those factors were playing within her. And the creation is still really at the early stage. So somebody was interested to know who was she in her previous life, and for that matter, who was Dhruva's mother in her previous life. But so she's an example of this destructive principle. This chart is from that earlier understanding. The cause of Suruchi's reacting is all these factors. And then the behavior, the harsh speech. And Dhruva doesn't respond, he reacts. He becomes deeply hurt. And when he turns to his father, and his father says nothing, he storms out of the palace. Here's her words. My dear child, you do not deserve to sit on the throne or on the lap of the king. Surely you are also the son of the king, but because you did not take your birth from my womb, you're not qualified to sit on your father's lap. Like basically, get down. My dear child, you're unaware that you were not born of my womb, but of another woman. Therefore, you should know that your attempt is doomed to failure. You are trying to fulfill a desire which is impossible to fulfill. Then she gives her recommendation. If you at all desire to rise to the throne of the king, then you have to undergo severe austerities. First of all, you must satisfy the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Narayana. And then, when you are favored by him because of such worship, you shall have to take your next birth from my womb. Now, what a 5-year-old boy understands about all of that, who knows? But for sure he understood the mood, and her body language was part of the message as well. And it was quite insulting. And that much he understood. Basically, you have to die and then take your next life. Take birth from my womb. So this is her pride and her envy. She was envious because somebody other than her son would become the king. So with her envy and her pride, she's speaking this way. Her pride is, although Krishna is the giver of spiritual awakening and liberation from birth and death, she's saying, pray to Krishna so you can take birth from my womb, not so you can go back home, back to Godhead, because he's the giver of liberation. When one is proud, one sometimes even thinks they're bigger than God. So you perform your austerity so you can take birth from my womb. And God becomes pulled down even lower than oneself. So that's her reaction, driven by pride and envy. Now we have the king's response or reaction. So the king heard everything. Maitreya narrates, "My dear Vidura, as a snake, when struck by a stick, breathes very heavily, Dhruva Maharaj, being struck by the strong words of his stepmother, began to breathe very heavily because of great anger." That's his reacting. He became very angry. When he saw that his father was silent and did not protest, he immediately left the place, the palace, and went to his mother. So the reaction of King Uttanapada, what was the cause? Behind everything, there's a cause. So why was he indifferent? I mean, how a mother could speak like that to a small child is outrageous. And how the king, the father of the child, could remain silent. Here's a nice little illustration to show the picture. Because of undue attachment. Or Hridaya Dorbalya. We know this phrase from Bhagavad Gita, right? Krishna says to Arjuna, how is this weakness of heart come upon you? It's not the behavior of an Aryan. So Hridaya Dorbalya, weakness of heart, is caused by undue attachment. And when there's undue attachment, even when you know what is to be done, you don't do. Hridaya Dorbalya. You don't make the right choices because of undue attachment. And that was his father's position. He was avoiding his duty or responsibility or natural quality or character of giving at least solace to his son. Son's bursting out crying, exhibiting, you know, kshatriya-like anger, and he says nothing. Does nothing. Because if he said something, did something, then who knows, maybe Saruchi might not like it. And then he won't get her favor anymore and all those things. Weakness of heart. Don't do the right thing when you know what the right thing is. So that's the reacting. Two of the reacting categories. Now here's Suniti, Dhruva's mother. She's a role model. She's modeling how to go to the response position in a very Krishna conscious way. One of the lessons we heard yesterday evening, same image, and the heading at the top is Prabhupada writes that hearing the story of Dhruva generates a feeling of pure devotional service in the hearts of the hearers. And one of those deliverers of that feeling of pure devotional service is his mother, because she's a pure devotee. She's a very exceptional personality. Responding, as opposed to reacting, has these two elements. They're color-coded. Compassion with direction. So she showed compassion immediately. When Dhruva Maharaj reached his mother, his lips were trembling in anger, and he was crying very grievously. Queen Suniti immediately lifted her son onto her lap. That's the compassion part. While the palace residents, who had heard all the harsh words of Saruchi, related everything in detail, thus Suniti also became greatly aggrieved. So in her responding, she wasn't numb. She had very strong emotion. Aggrieved at what she heard. Her poor son, having to hear this. Next, this incident was unbearable to Suniti's patience. She began to burn as if in a forest fire, and in her grief, she became like a burnt leaf and so lamented. So those are a whole bunch of negative emotions. She's not numb. She's not impersonal. She's not, oh, so what? As she remembered the words of her co-wife, her bright, lotus-like face filled with tears, and thus she spoke. So those are her emotions. She's a mother, so she's concerned about her son, not about herself. And so the action of compassion is immediately physical. She non-verbally took him on her lap and listened to him, tried to calm him, one can imagine. And then she didn't, reacting as you impulsively do something or say something or you got to act out something. That's reacting. And she doesn't do that. She has her own feelings, but she's rather seeking a solution to the situation. And this is one of the lessons that helps to not go into this reacting space, but a mode of goodness space. It's looking for a solution rather than getting steeped in the problem, and they can really be debilitating, just thinking about the problems. Here's a quote. I thought you'd like to hear what Henry Ford has to say about the Bhagavatam's message. Don't find fault, find a remedy. There's lots of things to say about fault finding, but she could easily have gone into that space. She didn't. She was also breathing very heavily, and she did not know the factual remedy for the painful situation. Not finding any remedy, she said to her son. So what's a mother going to do in a situation like this? Supposing your mother, or supposing you're a friend of somebody, and somebody comes to you with tears in their eyes and, you know, completely justified feelings of wrong, I've been wronged, and et cetera, et cetera. What are you going to do? Here's what Suniti does. Take shelter of higher principles. When the heart is fixed in devotion to Krishna, messages are taking shelter of a higher principle. My dear son, don't wish for anything inauspicious for others. Anyone who inflicts pains upon others suffers himself from that pain directly from the lips of Suniti. Don't ill wish anyone. That's not what the verse says. It's the paraphrase. So you look at the verse, there's amangalam in different colored letters. Amangalam, that's means wishing inauspiciousness for others. They'll get theirs, and I'll be an instrument to make sure they get theirs, and all that kind of thought and emotion. She's advising her son, don't do that. She's not doing that. And she's trying to, by example and by her words, instruct her son, don't do that. And one of the reasons is one who does that, that comes back to you. You wish ill upon others, it comes back to you. Wish others were wishing ill upon you. There's another meaning. Wishing ill upon others is fault finding, amangalam. O son, don't find fault in others, because those who have given suffering to others previously will receive the same in this life. That's commentary. Do not find fault, amangalam, in your stepmother. You have experienced the results of sins you have committed in previous births, since the person who gives suffering to others in a previous life receives it back in this life. That's not a nice pill. It's not so, in many cases, it's not comforting to understand that when some misfortune comes, it's your own past doings coming back to you. I like telling this story because I heard it so many times from Peter Burwash. Anyone know the name, Peter Burwash's name? And don't know. Peter Burwash is a motivational speaker. He had association with Prabhupada in Hawaii, where he previously lived. He now lives in California. And when he was living in Hawaii, he was a trainer of tennis trainers. He had a tennis school, and he was quite successful. He's like a high energy, you know, powerful personality. He never became initiated. He's still Peter Burwash, but he had such devotion for Prabhupada. And whenever Prabhupada came to Hawaii, he would go and associate with him. And Prabhupada was very affectionate, naturally, in reciprocation with Peter. So he has lots of Prabhupada stories of interacting with Prabhupada in Hawaii. And one of them goes like this. Because he was earning money, and at those days, many of the devotees, like myself, were, you know, left college and their careers and stuff just to do full-time devotional service. And so the temple didn't have much of a congregation. It wasn't even a concept of congregation. But Peter was a congregation member. It was rare. You know, somebody that earned money. And so he gave the temple $500, which at that time was a good sum of money. And some days later, the temple president ran away and took his $500 with him. And the next time Prabhupada came to visit Hawaii, along with other things Peter shared, he shared what happened. And then, like I've heard this story from him at least six times. Prabhupada's words, that was not very good, but don't blame the instrument of your own karma. And so he, you know, the way Peter tells the story is like, you know, emotional and energy packed. And it struck him. That is, so the lesson was what happened, the theft of his money, was he was getting a reaction for something that he had done in the past. And it was universal justice, not that what the person did was okay. Because it's justified because you did something like that and here comes the reaction. But don't blame the instrument of your karma was Prabhupada's words. So there are instruments of our karma. And when that comes, we're advised to be accepting. And at least, two things. In a negative sense, don't get into this reacting, retribution, get back mode. That's, you're being sucked into the illusory energy by doing that. One becomes a victim of Maya by doing that. So don't do that. That was the training from his mother. And Narada comes along and says the same thing, essentially. Different language, but same thing, essentially. And the second point is acceptance of karma, acceptance of someone being an instrument of one's karma, doesn't mean, therefore, just become a human punching bag. And anytime somebody does something mean, you just smile because you're a human punching bag. But acceptance means don't get into this reaction mode. And then in the reflective mode, you can consider what your options are and act from that place of goodness and thoughtful contemplation of what's best, but don't get into the fault-finding blaming, because blaming those who deal with this whole science of counseling and negative emotions, as soon as blaming, the victim mentality, thing add to the negative emotion. It doesn't resolve it. There are other actions and solutions beyond blaming. Here's a reference that's related from the story of Maharaj Parikshit and the sage. The devotees of the Lord are so forbearing that even though they are defamed, cheated, cursed, disturbed, neglected, or even killed, they are never inclined to avenge themselves. I don't get it. If you're killed, how can you avenge yourself? But the point is, however, whatever the degree is of wrongdoing that may be done to you, then to take revenge or to avenge yourself is not. So neither the sage nor the king, because the king was cursed to die. And he didn't go and do something because he was cursed to die. He was accepting. And it turned out, because he's Maharaj Parikshit, he went swiftly back home, back to Godhead. That was the part of the plan. But he didn't get into the reacting mode, is the point. So the topic, this little subsection, is react versus respond. So there's a response dynamic. And the important dynamic here is taking shelter of higher principles. She says further, my dear boy, whatever has been spoken by Suruchi, your stepmother, although very harsh to hear, is factual. What was that factual? Take up the worship of Vishnu. And the subset is accepting the karma factor. Therefore, if you desire at all to sit, so she's facilitating his desire, not the anger and retaliation desire, but the desire to sit on the throne. If you at all desire to sit on the same throne as your stepbrother Uttama, then give up your envious attitude, number one, and immediately try to execute the instructions of your stepmother and give up envy. So although what she said was harsh and really nasty, I have a nickname for her. Sunasti. So, envy. She's proud and envious, the stepmother. And the advice that Dhruva is being given by his mother is give up envy. And the retaliation because of it. So the comment, interesting graphic. Envy is like a hungry demon with lots of sharp teeth, which can eat away any positive qualities. Pride and envy have that capacity. It destroys everything good. Beware of pride, beware of envy. It destroys everything good. One of the congregation members here in Naperville was asking, can I speak about the Kali Leela this time? Because they struggle with envy. So we're doing this instead. And then after this is over, we'll go into the Kali Leela. Because envy is a big, big, bad quality to overcome. Kali had it really big time. So next, this is a little lesson that I learned from Adi Purusha. Adi Purusha is one of the Bhakti Shastri instructors, I think, at the VIHE. And he's because he teaches in Vrindavan, Ananda Vrindavan, and he have a nice relationship in Brajabihari because they lived in Vrindavan for so long. So he comes to Potomac from time to time and gives a seminar. So he gave a seminar where this was the theme that I just took. Credit goes to Adi Purusha. The acceptance message. Notice on the bottom right, that's a key. And the upper left, that's a lock in the shape of a heart. So to unlock the heart, acceptance is very valuable. So this is his message from Bhagavad Gita class. When we don't accept an undesired event, it becomes anger. When we accept it, it becomes tolerance. When we don't accept uncertainty, it becomes fear. When we accept it, it becomes adventure. When we don't accept others' bad behavior towards us, it becomes hatred. When we accept it, it becomes forgiveness. Notice, acceptance it's forgiveness, tolerance, it's other, you know, positive emotions and qualities. When we don't accept others' success, it becomes jealousy or envy. When we accept it, it becomes inspiration. And then this is the punchline to all of this. Acceptance is the key to handling life well. Going back to that yin-yang symbol at the beginning, that we're in the world of duality, we're in the world where it's sometimes this and sometimes that, and it's just the nature of the place. So if you don't like it, you know, you can be unhappy all the time because it's not what you like. But acceptance isn't like, oh, I like it. But you tolerate it, and you have a higher principle. You have a higher purpose to life. And you work on that higher purpose, higher principles. That's the acceptance message. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur writes, I like this. My weeping, Suniti, her acceptance is, my weeping has been written on my forehead by the Creator since birth. It's my karma. That is to say, she married, she had a wonderful child, and the husband, the king, not just like didn't pay much attention to her, she just was not even in the palace anymore. She was like totally neglected. I'm sure that wasn't a good feeling. But she didn't lose her qualities because of it. And her affection for her son is that her son should be happy. And she knew how. She was accepting her situation as it was. And being supportive of her son, achieving all of what he wanted to achieve. Really super mom. Response of a devoted heart takes shelter of the capital one, that's the supreme one, who is the shelter of higher principles. Lotus feet of Krishna and an image of a little, two little chicks taking shelter under the wings of their mother, the protective mother. That's Suniti. He's giving shelter to Dhruva and pointing to the shelter of the Lord's lotus feet very explicitly. It's really nice what she says. Without further delay, you must engage yourself in worshiping the lotus feet of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. All this negative emotion, anger, crying, wailing, she's redirecting it to a positive place. If you desire to be seated like your brother, then without envy of Suruchi, execute the true words uttered by her. Worship the lotus feet of the Lord. And then she describes the lotus feet of the Lord. The Supreme Personality of Godhead is so great that simply by worshiping his lotus feet, your great-grandfather, Lord Brahma, acquired the necessary qualifications to create this universe. Although he is unborn and he is the chief of all living creatures, he is situated in that exalted post because of the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whom even great yogis worship by controlling the mind and regulating the life air. That's Lord Brahma, his great-grandfather. Then comes his grandfather. Your grandfather, Swayambhuva Manu, executed great sacrifices with distribution of charity, and thereby, with unflinching faith and devotion, he worshipped and satisfied the Supreme Personality of Godhead. By acting in that way, he achieved the greatest success in material happiness and afterwards achieved liberation, which is impossible to obtain by worshipping the demigods. Now, Swami Bhuvamana was still around. He attained liberation without going anywhere, but he attained the liberated state. So now here's a nice image. This is the Vartma Pradarshika Guru principle. She is like the mother pointing out something to the little girl, the daughter. She's pointing to the lotus feet of Suniti, is pointing to the lotus feet of Krishna. You should take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is very kind to his devotees. Person seeking liberation from the cycle of birth and death. Always take shelter of the lotus feet of the Lord in devotional service, becoming purified by executing your allotted occupation. Just situate the Supreme Personality of Godhead in your heart, and without deviation for a moment, engage always in his service. She is performing a guru function. She's mother, little boy, but she's doing the guru function. But she is very qualified. She's living it herself, and she's teaching it to her son. That's the best combination, by words and by her own personal example. Vishwanath writes, she's saying essentially, the Lord is affectionate to his servant. He will have more affection for you, his servant, than the affection of millions of mothers like me. Nice. Vishwanath. She has such extreme faith in Krishna, although her own situation is difficult. Fix your mind. Fix him in your mind, purified by bhakti dharma. That's the message. We're getting bhakti right away. He doesn't pick up on the bhakti part. He picks up on, he stays with, I want to get back. My dear Dhruva, as far as I am concerned, I do not find anyone who can mitigate your distress but the Supreme Personality of Godhead, whose eyes are like lotus petals. Many demigods, such as Lord Brahma, seek the pleasure of the Goddess of Fortune. But the Goddess of Fortune herself, with the lotus flower in her hand, is always ready to render service to the Supreme Lord. She's a great teacher, a great mother, great personality. And because of her doing what she has done for her son, both by words and by her action, she goes back to Godhead with Dhruva. That comes at the very end. So this is the last slide. The great sage Maitreya continued, the instruction of Dhruva Maharaja's mother, Suniti, was actually meant for fulfilling his desired objective. Therefore, after deliberate consideration, and with intelligence and fixed determination, he left his father's house. Now, it doesn't say this in the Bhagavatam, but other commentaries make reference to other Puranas. I forget which Purana that says, when he asked his mother, very well, find Vishnu. Can you tell me how I can find Vishnu? She says, I'm just a lady. I don't know about these things so much. But I hear that great sages, they go to the forest. And somehow in the forest, they find Vishnu. He said, very well, I'm leaving right now. Heading for the forest. And he up and left. Now, the boy is, he's a boy. His age, you know, there's different indications, but one of the indications is he's 5 years old. What mother's going to send their son to the forest at 5 years of age? It's against motherhood. It's not possible. But she does it. That's also commented on. She knew the risks, but she also had faith in Vishnu. He's going to find Vishnu. Vishnu will protect him. that much faith she had. It's something like Krishna speaking, it's not the same, but it's something like Krishna speaking to the gopis. You know, to break the religious principles of leaving your home against the instruction of your families to come meet in the dead of the night. You know, it's very difficult to do what you've just done. And to do what Suniti just did, it's very difficult. It's not human. She's an extraordinary personality. Dhruva's very, very fortunate to have such an extraordinary mother. You know, I don't advise sending your child to the forest at 5 years of age. Even without a lunchbox. I mean, Mother Yasoda sent Krishna with other coward boys when he had lunch. Dhruva had nothing. So we don't imitate, but we understand principles, and we shall learn from the principle of having full faith in the personality of Godhead. I don't know anyone except the Supreme Personality of Godhead who can mitigate your distress. So go to him. Take shelter, full shelter of him. And did. Okay, so that's the evening section. And Monday's section is termination or determination. That's the topic for it. Because so this weekend is going to be, I've spent a lot of time preparing for a Govardhan Parikrama, virtual, slides, photos, and all the places and stories and things. So this will continue Monday evening, Krishna permitting. Let's see if there's some comments or discussion. Little family reunion situation here. Yeah.
Two-fold question. You need a mic?
Yeah,
Guru Maharaj, a two-fold question. Mother Suniti, what led to her, or is there any writing or any research that you may have done regarding what led up to her unflinching faith in Krishna?
Yeah. There's not detailed. The mention, however, is made that who is her husband is Uttanapada, and her father, his father is Swayambhuva Manu. Swayambhuva Manu is one of the Mahajans. So she received from Swayambhuva Manu. And she knows about Brahma. You know, it doesn't say what association she had with Brahma, but she knew Brahma's and Brahma's teachings and Brahma's bhakti, and certainly she had Swayambhuva Manu's direct association. And she was filled through her, she received her bhakti in that way. Narada is involved later. So we don't know, because Narada often has these conversations with people that we don't hear about. Like, you know, how Rukmini heard about Krishna was from Narada. There's no detail of Narada speakers and, hey, Rukmini. But he did. Matchmaker. Or instrument of Krishna. So, Swayambhuva Manu. And maybe Narada was in there somewhere too.
The second part of the question is, in contrast, we saw how the father, Uttanapada, reacted.
Yeah.
Was there any redemption for him? Is there anything about what he did after Guru Maharaj left?
Oh yeah, he was devastated. The remorse or the regret was intense. You know, for a Vaishnava, that's purification. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't do anything. He was a wreck. Narada knew that. Narada came and visited him. After speaking to Dhruva, he went to visit him. And to some extent, he was pacified. But he was a wreck, even after that, because what a horrible thing. And then the redemption was Dhruva's coming back and he became purified through Dhruva's association. And when Dhruva became king, he went to follow Dhruva's footsteps. He went to the forest to follow. So the fault or the wrong was his over attachment that blinded him. I mean, there has to be some attachment for husband for wife or wife for husband, but over attachment can lead to bad judgment and, you know, doing wrong things with good intention, but, you know, wrong decisions and wrong things, too much attachment. Yeah.
So Maharaj, you were talking about Mother Suniti and she gave Dhruva Maharaj the advice to go to the forest, find...
She didn't say go to the forest. She said shelter of Vishnu.
Take shelter of Vishnu.
Yeah.
And he will...
He put two and two together.
Yeah. take shelter of Lord Vishnu and he will take care of your miseries.
Yes.
And at that point, for Dhruva Maharaj, his misery was that his material desire was not being...
That's it. And he was insulted. So he wanted, I'll show you. He's a Kshatriya.
Yeah. He had that get back.
Yes, yes.
But Mother Suniti's, I'm trying to understand, when she said Lord Vishnu will take care of your miseries, she wasn't so much saying that he'll take care of your material.
Even in relation to Swayambhuva Manu, his grandfather or her father or father-in-law,
mm-hmm.
He had all material facility and then liberation. So your material will also be taken care of.
Yeah.
You want a kingdom? He'll give you the kingdom. He'll give you, you've developed attachment for him and you're all set up. So material and spiritual.
Okay. So she was saying both material and spiritual.
Yes. She wasn't teaching Shuddha Bhakti. He wasn't ready to hear that anyways, and she knew. Narada speaks Shuddha Bhakti, and, you know, testing him, it bounced.
Yeah.
She didn't say Shuddha Bhakti. She said material spiritual.
That was it. And, I had one more.
Yeah.
I was just listening to yesterday's class and was saying that Dhruva Maharaj, his austerities were so intense. And we had just finished reading the seventh canto with Prahlad Maharaj and Hiranyakashipu. And I was, even in that, while we were reading about Hiranyakashipu's austerities, those were intense.
Severe.
And he had so much knowledge as well.
Yeah.
But yet, you know, their paths are so different.
Yes.
So what I could, at least my understanding and what I could, I was just thinking of the difference, why those paths are so different. And I was just thinking that Dhruva Maharaj had association. He had his mother, he had very good counsel from his mother, and he had Narada Muni's association.
Yes.
Whereas Hiranyakashipu just didn't have that. And of course for Dhruva Maharaj, he had Lord Vishnu appear before him in person.
But there's more to it. Because Ravana, for example, he had a fantastic father.
Mm.
And he had knowledge of the Vedas.
Mm.
And from a fantastic father, a perfected person, a very elevated person, his father. But he fell into bad association.
Mm.
And he became further corrupted. I mean, he had a tendency. It wasn't that, you know. So bad association can take away good qualities. So it was the main difference, austerities, is bhakti, no bhakti, or the aversion to bhakti. Hiranyakashipu, you know, real big aversion to bhakti. And Ravana. Oh, so Sura and Asura.
Yeah.
You know, Prabhupada's way of saying it. Do you accept this personality Godhead? No. Demon. Demoniac mentality, that's at its heart. So one may do austerities, or one may do austerities, and one will misuse it and one will properly use it. Sukriti Duskriti.
Thank you.
We're doing this little protocol of wiping this thing down so that, well, everyone's got their masks on. It's just kind of a good show. We wipe it down.
Maharaj, I have two questions.
Okay.
The first one was with Suniti, and another example that had come to my mind was also Vidura when he was cast out by Duryodhana.
Yeah.
And both of them seem to have a very similar reaction where the first, like the gut reaction was pain, but it was immediately followed by this is like the arrangement of the Lord. And so, that was like that because of their existing devotion, that's allowing them to go past the pain and see the opportunity to turn towards the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll speak for myself, in my life, my gut reaction would be pain, and that next step of turning towards the Lord will not be the natural next step because I don't have that devotion yet. So then what hope is there for me to turn towards Krishna if I'm not at their stage yet?
Well, good association and good sadhana. If your compass is headed in the right direction, the maturity may not be there, but you're not going to collapse. And your faith may take a hit, but it doesn't get crushed. So through good sadhana and good association, faith directed towards the wholesomeness, the spiritual wholesomeness. And then you carry on according to your inner strength and where you have shelter. And it's revealing the other shelters that have been my shelter and then just got damaged. So it's an opportunity those situations are good for introspection. And it's really good to have good association where you can go through that with somebody that doesn't just pat you on the back. I mean, she patted Dhruva, but she didn't, she was 5-year-old boy. She's telling him the real story. So a person that can speak the truth, that's, they know, and their relationship is such that they can speak the truth directly. That's really helps. That's your best friend. And being somebody else's best friend, it's not like, let me tell you, you're Maya. It's being able to, in the right way, in the right mood, knowing the person, steer in the direction of shelter and Krishna. That's being another's best friend.
Thank you. And my other question was, I think my main takeaway was that a devotee does not respond to some offense that was dealt against them. But my question is, when an offense is done against a devotee, while that devotee may not be responsible to respond to that, offensive person, should not all other devotees respond to that offensive person on their behalf?
I'm very familiar with this territory from this, particularly from the Dhruva story. Acceptance doesn't mean silence or, roll with the punch or something like that. It doesn't mean let them become a punching bag because they're just a very humble person and they don't mind being a punching bag. So I'll just like, okay, they want to be a punching bag. The response, as opposed to reacting, should be thoughtful. For the pleasure of Krishna, what's appropriate for me? Then we have some standards from Rupa Goswami, but the particular expression of one of those options, I have to very carefully consider that the thoughtfulness behind how you respond as opposed to react, having it, so like Prabhupada to Peter Burwash, Prabhupada responded. He it's the person that ran away with the money was Gaurasundara, who also tried to steal the property. And Prabhupada put in place measures so people can't steal property, according to what he understood with American law. So if someone else is dealt with wrongly, I need to take a stand. We had this nice discussion with Sundri Radha about her feelings of justice needs to be upheld. And just being silent when there's injustice, it's unconscionable. She can't just, so let's talk to her about this because we spent some time. But you may or may not do something immediately. Many cases, pausing and considering carefully what is to be done. Some cases you can't wait, but if you can, it's good to be thoughtful and little brainstorming. Here's some possible. What are my options? You roll some out, some are left. What seems to be best? You consult some wise people. What's appropriate? So keep two things in mind. I don't want to depart from the lotus feet of Krishna, and I want to please Krishna. So that, you know, where you are and where you want to go. And then so that'll help guide what you're going to say or do in relation to someone being, being on the receiving end of some injustice. Here we go, over here. Do a little wiping with that little cloth on the top of your speak, part two. It's nice. It smells like alcohol.
My question was related to the part where you were talking about transforming those negative emotions into accepting emotions. I guess I was just wondering, how does one participate in that transformation when the mind is so adamant to stay in those? Like, what's the light switch? What's the switch that kind of makes that transition when
it's practice and purity and good association. Associate with people that have that capacity better than you. They have wisdom. At least, you know, when you're going through something and someone else isn't going through the same something, they may feel like Suniti felt about her son having just been through a horrible thing. She was, you know, she was really hurt by what he went through. But so if you have a friend or a wise person or a mentor or somebody or a few somebodies like that, not just, you know, to pat you, but to help you by their spiritual strength and their wisdom and their Krishna consciousness to move from that bewildered by that negative emotion thing that's going on to, you know, seeing some light and how you can, the principle is simple. To do it is another thing, but the simple principle is, here's this welling of this energy, and I feel it. It's clouding my consciousness, and it's strong. And I'm feeling uncomfortable about that thing happening. So find some way to direct that same energy towards something that's wholesome. A visual for me is when there's a spill, supposing in the kitchen there's the water spilling over and it's heading for, you know, something. So make a line with your hand and the water that's going this way will start to go that way because you give it another path. It's the same energy. Just give another path to move in.
That makes sense.
It's easier said than done, but that the principle works. somebody's in some, you know, the crisis situation or calamity, misfortune situation, there's a lot of energy going on. No, how to direct that energy towards wholesomeness. Mm-hmm. That's the question, that's the topic. So it takes practice, it takes wisdom, it takes determination, it takes control of the mind and senses. That's where this austerity thing comes in. It's just then by practice of austerity, when you don't have a problem, you have control of your mind and senses when you have a problem. And that so you can just, with intelligence, because that's what it says. After deliberate consideration and with intelligence and fixed determination, he left his father's house. There's that negative energy. With intelligence and determination, I'm going to take that energy over here. He considered. He made a decision. He's a little boy. Little boys don't usually have a lot of, you know, anyway. But that's the principle. So strong intelligence, capacity for not allowing yourself to be consumed by that negative emotion, redirecting it towards a wholesome place. And it doesn't, you know, it can be an intermediate place, short of what Dhruva did.
Those emotions can be powerful.
Yeah, it redirected. And that we did, the how-to is just touched on. Have good sadhana, have good friends, good mentors. Look at your faith. Look at this faith that I have. It's so soft and pliable. Little, you know, something that's not so calamitous has become a calamity. So let me renew my commitment to the bhakti process. And then I want to have strength. I don't get run over by these negative emotions. And it's doable, even for a young boy.
Thank you, Marge.
Okay. Let's do some online questions. Multiple.
Twelve. This question is from Rajeshwari Pranamataji from Bangalore. If Dhruva Maharaj had accepted the initial instructions of Narada Muni and had gone back to his father's kingdom, how would be beneficial for his spiritual life?
If he had accepted Narada's initial instruction, he would have more quickly come to the position of pure bhakti. Because following instruction is how you come to pure bhakti, not just going off to the forest and doing austerities. It would have played out differently, obviously, but he would have achieved pure bhakti by following Narada.
The second part of the question is, in our lives, how do we take instructions as it is without filtering with our mentality?
Well, become pure and then you can take it as it is. Or strive to become pure and you can take it as it is.
This question is from Radhika Priya Mataji, St. Louis. If one suffers, you were mentioning that if one suffers from another person for their previous karma, how long is one supposed to tolerate and accept that it's due to my own past karma? Also, I want to know how should one face...
Let's do one at a time. How long? That's up to Krishna. And to repeat a prior message, acceptance and tolerance doesn't mean say nothing, do nothing, just continue to be a punching bag. That's not what it means. But don't get into this reacting mode. Rather go into a proactive, what's the best response to the situation mode. Go into reflective, devotional, mode of goodness mode. and you still have options. The toleration doesn't go up. Tolerance doesn't get abandoned.
So Mataji says, also I want to know how one should face it and move on.
How we should do what?
Face the issue.
Well, that's what we've been discussing. The issue is, recognize what the issue is and accept what the issue is, and then start to consider what your options are.
This question is from Sri Radhika Mataji. Suniti told her son, those who have given suffering to others will receive the same in this life. Sometimes one may be able to go beyond the desire to avenge, knowing that the wheel of justice may move slow, but it's very fine. However, you spoke during the winter retreat of Mother Draupadi, who, even when she had the chance to exact retribution for the death of her sons, had no desire for vengeance by virtue of feeling empathy for the mother of the wrongdoer. So, in perfection are the two elements of responding that you spoke of, compassion and acting with direction versus devoid of even a subtle sense of finding solace in knowing that karma is inescapable?
Well, Ashwatthama's karma wasn't escapable. Draupadi's consideration was beyond giving the required correction to a wrongdoer. Her contemplation was, who will be impacted if the correction for his wrongdoing looks like this? So you're taking principles, but you have to look at yet additional principles. The principle of maturity. One of the principles of maturity is to consider the consequence of an action, who's going to be impacted. And if someone like Kripi is going to be so negatively impacted, I don't want that path of action. And she was right.
This question is from Yashodanandan Prabhu. In conflict resolution, one guiding principle given is to not prescribe the solution. Rather, help the victimized person to come to a conclusion of resolution by themselves. Also, Mother Suniti spoke very clearly or very directly to Dhruva when he was crying, saying his stepmother is right. In a modern context, for most people seeking solace, they wouldn't likely react well to that directness, aggravating the hurt. What takeaways can we receive from this pastime with respect to people approaching us in distress?
Okay, I read that section, don't get stuck in the problem, but look for a solution. I was also thinking of that principle of conflict resolution and mediation. She wasn't specifically saying, prescribing a solution other than, transcendental solution. Take shelter of the person. How he's going to take care of this situation, I can't say. But he's all powerful, and his kindness is he'll find a way. So she was speaking of a spiritual principle, a higher principle. And there's nothing wrong in conflict mediation to draw somebody's, attention to a higher principle. And second is, she knows her son. She didn't say to Narada, she didn't say to Dhruva what Narada said to Dhruva. She didn't say, he wanted his kingdom. She didn't say you should give up this desire to get the kingdom. She knew her son. Mm-hmm. She didn't even hint at that. Here's how you can get your kingdom. The transcendental Lord, beyond your imagination, can take care of your material and spiritual requirements. I think that addresses both questions.
This is from Radha Vallabha Prabhu. The practicing devotees are still under the modes of nature during Anartha Nivritti stage. So can we expect that can be reactionary behaviors in practicing devotees until one is situated in mode of goodness?
Well, we don't imitate, but we follow. So here's a model of an ideal person. And we're not ideal because we're in the modes of nature. But we can follow directionally, as much as it's our capacity to do so, the ideal model and cultivate it and move towards it to our capacity. Take strength and because there's strength just even in the narration. There's spiritual potency in the narration.
This is from Sunil Sharma Prabhu. How can we show compassion with direction for a devotee who has Hridaya Daurbalyam?
Who has done what?
For a devotee who has Hridaya Daurbalyam, or weakness of heart, and undue attachment.
Well, you help them by, you know, banging him on the side of the head. Hey, my dear friend. See this left elbow? Boop! Hey, you're overly attached, man. You know, it depends on the relationship. But you can, you know, be a comforting friend and let them know. That's, you know, depends on the relationship. You don't overstep the relationship, but depending upon the relationship.
That was actually the second part of the question. While doing this, how to also ensure that the relationship is not harmed and it grows stronger?
Well, you invest in the relationship. You ask them, do you mind if I give you a little feedback, Prabhu? Sure. You know, so you don't violate the relationship, but you act within the relationship.
This next question is from Ramesh Ramachandran Prabhu. First question, this verse helps to remove the negative emotion.
It helps to give you a path to move on, to deal with those negative emotions. It doesn't remove the negative emotion.
He has...
Please find my little sharing about this particular slide and question. He says, number one, this verse helps to remove negative emotion. Number two, it takes away anger more towards the person who inflicted the pain. Number three, thinking this way also gives the ability to forgive others. And four, what I heard from Brahmanical quality is patience and forgiveness, and so on. And I mean, the five... This I could see as a wonderful practical application from Srimad Bhagavatam. So, question. When I'm sitting in this lecture, I understand I should do like this. But in day-to-day situation, how do I remember to practically apply these principles?
Sadhana Bhakti. Practice. Regularly. Hear regularly. Chant regularly. Associate regularly. Make your heart clean. You know, do sadhana bhakti nicely, then it becomes possible to stay fixed like that. Next.
This is from Mahati Kirti Mataji. In empathic listening seminar, I heard that when kids are angry and hurt and they express something out of anger and say words best response as a parent, I was told, was to just acknowledge their feeling. They won't be ready to listen to philosophy. Sometimes when they calm down, they forget their problem, or we can correct them later. So I'm trying to understand here, Mother Suniti said no to think bad for his stepmother. Kindly help me understand, how should one respond in such a situation in this age of Kali?
Well, it's not in this age of Kali, it's your child. Know your child. And depending upon knowing your child, you can do as was advised, or you can do as Suniti does, or somewhere in between. Knowing the personality and the relationship. You have to customize. But that advice that she repeated, is good advice. Pretty standard advice. And it's as much as you can go in the direction of encouraging, taking shelter of higher principle, do that. As much as you can, depending upon the child and the relationship.
This question is from Sanchari. She has a comment and a question. The comment is, when thinking of Dhruva Maharaj's mother and her ability to expertly guide Dhruva, even though she herself was in pain, it seems to come from a place of personal experience, and it reinforces the impact our own experiences have in the service of another. There is so much hope for our own progress in this pastime. Thank you for continuously sharing these pastimes. That's a comment. And her question is there a reason why Uttanapada's second wife was so nasty to a 5-year-old child? Is there any backstory that could help us understand her actions? Was she just nasty?
Well, Amol Bakshi was researching this in the Skanda Purana and, Shiva Purana, and I don't have reliance. I don't know anything from the Bhagavatam that gives her background, or any of our Gaudiya Vaishnava Acharyas. I don't know. There's probably something somewhere I don't know. Next. That's it. We can end. It's late. Anything? Srila Prabhupada ki? Right.